We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse.
Greetings and welcome back to another exciting installment of the Fifth Column Podcast. This is your weekly rhetorical assault on the news cycle, the people that make it, and occasionally ourselves. I am Camille Foster. I am so thrilled to be here today. I'm in marvelous form. I'm properly medicated with both the meth and the THC, and I'm very excited. It's great to be here. It's great to be with Matt Welch and Michael Moynihan, two deplorable criminals who are involved in all sorts of nefarious activities. But you know what? We're actually pretty good guys, and it is fun to talk to them on the podcast. Yeah.
Well, it's good to talk to you both, and I need a little bit of time before I go uptown to fight the Upper West Side Intifada.
Are you heading over there?
You're going over there?
No, because I was in college once, and I've seen stupid people acting stupid when they're 19 years old, and I don't need to see it again. I can see it on...
You mean brave freedom fighters, brilliant intellectuals who understand all of the complicated nuance of foreign policy, international relations.
And seem to really like Hamas. But the thing is, if we were in college, I mean, Matt has talked about this, I think... You know, maybe you had South Africa divestment stuff when you were in college.
Just when and the tail end of that.
Mine was various Free Mumia and the rest of it, various cop killers that they were desperate to get out so they could kill more cops. But if we had the technology and the platforms that we do now, TikTok, you know, Instagram, et cetera, and camera phones, I wonder if there would be enormous political debates on, you know, television and the editorial pages on CNN, et cetera, about those issues. I wonder how much of this is not that unique, but I'm of mixed feelings about this. I think it actually is quite unique in certain ways.
I think that it's, I think about the South Africa stuff a lot, which peaked the year before I came at UC Santa Barbara. They had a shanty town for basically a year out in the main plaza to protest it. And that was pretty big all over the country. There was a lot of that. And it was also something where the exact policy implementation of what people were asking for, there's a debate over that, and good people could disagree. But the part of it that was pretty relatable from the beginning was that apartheid really sucked. It was bad. It was basically totalitarian racism or dictatorial racism.
I'm surprised to hear this say from you.
I know.
I thought you've been on record as a long time as an apologist for apartheid.
And the U.S.
An apartheid truther.
The U.S. government, even though Ronald Reagan, for one, was someone who was very vocally critical of the apartheid regime, was nonetheless friendly with South Africa as a bulwark in the Great Cold War struggles and other types of regional conflicts. But like the basic moral argument, the students were kind of right. It's a question of like, is the smart thing to do to get the University of California to divest the money? Okay, well, we'll talk about that kind of thing. I think what's strikingly different this time around, in addition to the cam phones and everything else like that, is that at best, being generous, students might be half right and half disastrously wrong. In a way that's morally off-putting and represents divides that are kind of interesting generationally, partisanly, and otherwise. So that feels a little bit different. And then it's just situated, and Michael and I talked about this on Sunday when we recorded, but it's situated against the context that Camille likes to talk about a lot, which is that we have this weird political violence moment that we didn't make an agreement about. Like, there was violence in a lot of different ways in 2020 and 2021. And out of it, the participants in those violence have pretty unidirectional interpretation about the uses and the horriblenesses of violent activities. And given that it's a presidential year, that's a kind of a scary cocktail.
Well, it's particularly weird that no one is discussing what these children want and what their plan is, and it is divestment from Israel. Now, does anyone that you know who has been involved in these conversations, you know, political conversations, just privately or posting about them publicly, have they decided to ask what that means? Because what it essentially means is that Colombia, which has a enormous amount of money under its control. And, you know, you see this with Yale and their investment strategy, which is quite big. I mean, there was a guy who came in there and made them a ton of money. And essentially what it means is that you have a number of things, whether you are, you know, like index funds of the S&P, if you have ETFs, which is, you know, a whole bunch of individual stocks wrapped under an ETF. And they're saying that in those ETFs, in those index funds, whatever it might be, there might be companies in there that are supporting Israel. They're not, they don't meet the BDS, the boycott, divest, and sanction standards of what divestment from Israel means. And that could be something like Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola, people that have, you know, sell things in the occupied territories, et cetera. And so what it means is kind of unclear. And is it even possible for a university that has big investments like that to actually, quote unquote, divest, beyond the fact that it is incredibly silly to suggest that a country should be isolated for responding to what happened on October 7th, responding to an invasion with itself, a counter invasion, right, of Gaza. If you think that is so morally reprehensible, that you have to take all money out. And of course, this predates October 7th. I mean, the BDS movement is a very old movement. It's the singular punishment of a country like Israel. So how does this even happen? How does one even do that? It's totally secondary, tertiary to the conversation that we're having about it, which is, you know, is this morally right? And, you know, should they send the police? And are these people saying things that are anti-Semitic? Is that actually indicative of the entire movement? Well, let's just say this. If you covered the Tea Party, as both Matt and I did at the time, I don't think that was a conversation that was being had when you saw one guy with a poster of Obama with a, you know, a plate in his lip and a bone in his nose, which happened. And that was the entire movement, was obviously a reactionary racist movement. Whereas here, there is repeated and, you know, well, they're not people that are on campus. They're not Columbia students. Well, why are they there? Shouldn't they boot them off campus? If not only are they there, that they're intimidating Jewish students, or they're saying these things that are psychopathic in their idea of, like, we have to eliminate the state of Israel. I mean, that's what they're constantly saying. I mean, this is not a two-state solution type crowd. And you can say the two-state solution is a pipe dream at this point. But just, you know, in my mind, I mean, that's what I'd like to see. It's not possible at the moment, but that's what I wish to be. They don't seem to wish that at all. They want a ceasefire from one side. They don't talk about the hostages. And we saw today that the Hamas released a pretty gruesome hostage video, which was very well planned, because an American Israeli, which everybody forgets about, by the way, there are no Americans, if you know, because if you're both Israeli and American, if you have an American passport, they don't count you. So, I mean, if it was somebody like an American was kidnapped, like in Russia, as we see with the Wall Street Journal reporter, would have different conversations about it. But if you're an American Israeli there and you speak Hebrew, as this guy was doing in this hostage video released by Hamas, he has one hand that has been, his arm actually up to the elbow has been, I think it's up to the elbow, has been lopped off during the attack. So he's with no arm, one arm there. And he's saying, you know, the Netanyahu government has done enough. And you can see his eyes darting around, by the way, because he's reading something, which is very important when you're actually making these videos, to indicate that you're reading something by eyes darting on the prompter, which is what he's clearly doing. But they also chose him because his parents have been very, very vocal. And it's not an accident. But it was good to see that there was a hostage that is still alive. But that's not a conversation that these people are having. So I think that there's a moral collapse that's happened on campus a long time ago. And you see these professors that are coming out to support the protests and, you know, say, well, they shouldn't get arrested. They should be able to do this. But they are destroying the general function of the university, that Columbia has gone to, Zoom only classes at the moment. I mean, this is how disruptive this has been. But we saw, a final comment on this is, I saw Bob Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots.
That's saying, the massage parlor?
And frequenter of massage parlors. I mean, more, that's, you start with that.
Well, I think that's the better of the two data points, not the Patriots bit.
Criminal justice reformer.
Yes, criminal justice reformer, trafficker of women in Florida.
You know.
But he said, as many people did after October 7th, that he's not going to give any money to Colombia anymore. I have a humble suggestion here to the people that are doing this. I support you.
Subscribe to the Fifth Column.
Well, that's you have to subscribe to figure out these solutions to your problems.
never fly coach. Yeah.
You see these students. The New York Post did a very good thing about this, how unbearably privileged these people all are. They're, you know, a $90,000 a year education. They have very, very wealthy parents. Ilhan Omar's daughter, who said that she had been hit with a biological weapon or something. She's like, there are people, chemical weapons. She said on MSNBC, I was attacked with chemical weapons. I might starve to death because I can't get my student meals. And if you look at her Twitter feed, and this is true, in her Twitter bio, she has a hammer and sickle. We are far enough away from the Cold War now that people are very happily putting hammers and sickles, representative of one of the most, you know, bloodthirsty ideologies of the 20th century, which doesn't surprise me because she seems to support a bloodthirsty ideology in the Middle East too. I would say suspend those students for disrupting the university, for violating university policy. And then if they keep doing it, kick them out. And I would say to people like Bob Kraft, you should take your money out of Columbia, but give that money to people who are worthy and give it to people who aren't, you know, going and LARPing on campus and pretending that it's 1968 and playing revolutionary because they don't even know what they're doing at this point, but this is a fun activity. And, you know, fund students who are just like real students who want to go to university and can't afford it. Because what Columbia is, it's a bunch of fucking rich kids. And that is white, black, brown, Asian. It's like they have a rainbow of rich people. And that's what's important to them. They have the right color of rich person. So fuck you. Take your money to your upper middle class Benetton ad and give it to some kids who are worthy and are not, you know, half-wits that are shutting down the university and praising a terror group.
I would be remiss not to mention Zay Jelani, who is a pretty strident critic of the Israelis, and is on record about this if you're following him on X, but who wrote a piece for Persuasion back in March. And I think the title of it was How to Make Friends and Influence People. And it is him providing some advice and guidance to students, just like the circus clowns, who are creating havoc, on Columbia's campus. And I think you guys are correct to point out, like, the Tea Party is the correct analogy here. And Moynihan, I covered it as well. People will see if they go and, you know, look at the oeuvre. The fact is that it is almost certainly the case that most of the people participating in this aren't even remotely contemplating the implications of some of the slogans that they're saying are clearly not the worst possible actors imaginable. But there is a disturbing volume overtly anti-Semitic shit that you see in a lot of the footage from these demonstrations. And it is it's an actual problem, so much so that I find myself, who is decidedly allergic to like sensationalism of all sorts and worries constantly about whether or not this thing everyone is concerned about is a moral panic. Like, I'm very much on the, like, let's do the scale of 1 to 10 thing. Like, is this, are we actually, is everything totally fine? Or should we actually be making more analogies to like 1930s Germany?
I think that's too far, by the way. I just want to make sure that, I mean, I said on the podcast that we did the other night, Matt and I, that I think that I don't know exactly how endemic this kind of madness is to, or if it's just a few rotten apples or what. I mean, but the point being is that there are far more rotten apples then would precipitate a response if it were somebody talking about DEI. It was something correct, talking about, I'm protesting the DEI initiatives at Columbia or the Black Studies Department for being too radical, whatever. If somebody said, there's someone coming into our camp that we've set up on campus, you know, they said, there's a Zionist here. I mean, that's pretty fucking scary, by the way. There's a Zionist here. I mean, if you say,
let's join hands and walk them off the campus.
Yeah, I mean, if some black kid came in and said, there's a DEI guy here, like surround him. I mean, I think the reaction would be a little different.
I'm curious, yeah. Senator Cotton, what do you think your
wait, which one is
one
it?
Hand for this case, but you're Holly. What is the what are you expelling them or kicking them off campus? What is the infraction that you're hitting them with precisely? Just to know the limiting factor.
There's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, I'm not, you know, well read in what Columbia's policies are when students do things like this. I mean, they called the police and they had the police get them off campus because they were inhibiting the learning of other students. And that is an important thing. It's not about a speech issue. I am perfectly happy if they set themselves up there every day and, you know, complain about X, Y, and Z. And they're not like, you know, deactivating the card of a Jewish professor who's very, very pro-Zionist, who I think, by the way, is very over the top in his criticism is really over the top. I mean, it's, you know, not Berlin in 1938. That's an absurd comparison. I mean, I really do think it's an absurd comparison. It's bad, but it's not anything like that, which was about a year before the kind of wheels of genocide really started turning. Sort of 1940-41 is when it happened. So if you're suggesting that we're three years away from every Jew in America being rounded up and put on a cattle car, I would disagree with you.
You're wrong.
Yeah. So I think there's a little overstatement on both sides. But if you are, you know, preventing other students from actually participating in their studies, if you are mau-mauing other students and saying they can't speak here, I mean, that is obviously the thing that is concerning. I mean, is there an opportunity for other people to speak on campus and set up counter demonstrations, as it were? But if you see when the police are getting involved, and they don't want to get involved, they've been called by the university, and the university has suspended people and then kind of doubled back on that because they're afraid of what the reaction will be. I mean, Ilhan Omar's daughter was suspended. I think they've shortened that, and I think she's no longer suspended. She was going on MSNBC and things like that. But if there are infractions that violate university policy, right, and that it's just totally sensible stuff that, like, okay, it's time to leave the classroom that you're occupying. It's time to leave that your building that you're occupying because other people want to learn. I mean, that's where it goes too far for me. I mean, if your speech is prohibiting the learning or the speech of other people, then you have a problem. I don't care if they're on campus complaining, even if they're saying totally crazy things. I don't think you should be kicked out of university for saying that Hamas is right. I don't believe that.
Right.
But these are people that would not allow somebody, I suppose, who was in the alt-right, which I think is the analog on the right, because it has its own kind of genocidal and bloodthirsty ideology. I mean, is there a balance between that? For some reason, it seems that when you attack the state of Israel, you're given a pass. Now, my preferred policy here would be that nobody is bothered by this, whether it's a Richard Spencer or whether it's somebody with a, you know, Qassam Rocket Brigade sign saying, hurt these people. That sign, for instance, I hope that rockets following you, I imagine that falls afoul of university policy. I would imagine that threatening students with violence in that way, or I would imagine that that was, for me, I don't think that's an imminent threat. I don't think that that's something that you should actually punish somebody for. But my issue is that this is very selectively enforced. And when people are, you know, acting to a point where it's shutting down, you know, the Upper West Side in a way, I think you got to do something about it. And you can't be sitting there saying, oh, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine.
I want to point out something that we don't do nearly enough on this show is to revive our we totally called that shit certificate. Because when the college professors were hauled up front of Congress and absolutely shat the bed on live television, it was Harvard, it was MIT, it was Penn, right? What was the other one? It was not Columbia. And at the time, we were like, wow, Columbia dodged a bullet, because that stuff is deep in Columbia, and to a degree that, and I don't follow higher education stuff much at all, but Columbia has like a trifecta of elite feeder institutions, where the School for International Public Affairs is right up there with GMU, not GMU, the other one, George Washington, in DC.
George Mason.
It's not George Mason. It's the other one. You know, the guy, the thing.
George.
On the side.
Georgetown?
I don't Georgetown, know what you're talking about. Actually, Georgetown, yeah. Too many fucking Georges in Washington. Enough. He was great.
This is true.
Fucking, you know, killing for fun, yeah. But enough. The School for International Public Affairs totally feeds people into the State Department. The Teachers College is the single most influential feeder college into the education system in the country. I don't think it's particularly close. And the Journalism School is the most prestigious journalism school. Certainly always in the top five. So those three like elite makers are just right there. Plus you're in New York where New York things are happening, like shutting down bridges and acting all crazy. This is not surprising. We totally called this shit. And it's kind of interesting to watch and see. And like, it seems obvious that Columbia, is freaking out and doing bizarre things like blocking journalists from coming on campus. Like don't do that.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah.
It's funny. I'm just realizing that this is the first time we've recorded since I had that insane situation where I was taking off from SF to go up to Vancouver for TED. And as I was taking off, my wife texts me and tells me that she is like getting ready to get on the Golden Gate Bridge. I'd been stuck in traffic for like 30 minutes and would subsequently more than 2+ hours in traffic, which should have been a 10-minute commute. My daughter couldn't go to school that day. My son was in the back of the car, 2 years old, potty training, not wearing diapers, and proceeded to shit and piss himself for two hours
Palestine.
Because of the insane protests on the fucking bridge, which would go on for much, much longer. My wife was lucky to get out of it in 2 hours. I've seen text messages from like mom's groups she's a part of, or at least been told about them because she doesn't just, you know, defy the privacy or sanctity of those forums by allowing a man to see. I just take her phone when she ain't looking just to make show. For that, you can't be out there giving away what's mine. We gonna make show. But it was terrible. It was absolutely horrific. And I at some point do want to spill some tea about TED. And I know that we want to get to some other topics because we have Matt's colleague, CJ, who is going to talk to us about the most important story in America. And then there's other related stuff going on. But like
I want to say final thing on this. One final thing. Yeah. Just to really, really underscore this, because we live in an age and in a culture in which people enjoy taking things that you say and clipping them and out of context. But I want to say this, that we talked about this in the previous podcast too, is that this is literally nothing about speech. I could care less what you say. And if you want to say it on campus, I think people should have the right to say the things that they're saying. I find it quite helpful that they're saying the things that they say to see how deranged they have become. And it doesn't surprise me, particularly at Columbia, which has a lot of deranged people on its faculty that talk about this stuff in a deranged way. But it is blocking the bridges, which we've talked about quite a bit, which is, you know, not only does it not make friends, it is also harmful. I mean, your son turned into fucking Bobby Sands doing a dirty protest in the back of the car, you know, Baby Sands, that was like, it's like, I can't fucking believe it, these bastards.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that kind of stuff is like, you know, when you're doing this stuff in the university, if you're not letting people pass, if you're harassing them, my thing is that if that is a violation of university policy, I wish that it would be equally applied and fairly applied.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe those things, if I were to look at it, think those policies are themselves bad. I don't know the policies, but I know that a lot of this stuff would be very different if the political leanings of the protesters were different. And I don't have any problem with people protesting. In fact, I encourage it. But I think it's gone to a place where they've been given an inch, and now they're going to take it to a point where if you're shutting down the university, you should be shut down. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Because that's a violation of people's speech rights. If they can't go to class, that's a speech violation itself. So
the analogy is hardly complete and totally fair. But I mean, some of those scenes like frequently look like January 6th craziness to me. And I'm trying to imagine like aligned January 6ers like participating in these kinds of protests and them not being very quickly shoved into waiting police vehicles. I mean, it took hours to get those people off of the bridge. Although it sounds like the DA here in SF like actually wants to really go after them. But again, there's a universe of other things we want to talk about. You got the Adderall stuff coming. Trump's criminal prosecution is ongoing. Tesla is imploding. And the TikTok ban is finally going to be a thing, it seems. The Trump criminal proceedings stuff, I don't know that there's much to talk about there, but I do know he's been falling asleep in court a bunch, which makes me wonder if he's maybe suffering from the Adderall shortage or if he's just bored. Who is to say?
Dude, I did jury duty. I slept through about 40% of it, so I'm going to actually defend him on this one.
And what are the side
of course you
the
will.
Side effects of Ozempic again? Does that make you sleepy or it makes your dick shrivel?
But one thing I do know is, it makes you a great president.
Yeah.
So that's what Joe Biden needs. Is I know he's slim, but a little shot in MAGA.
But so much stuff we could get into. I'm curious. I mean, I wanted to tell you guys about Ted.
Do it.
Because this was my first time going out there for this thing. It is preposterously expensive to attend, so I was happy to get an invite from the Templeton Foundation to go talk about the doc series I produced, explaining the meaning of life. And I did not give a TED talk. I gave a talk at TED. Mm-hmm. And if you don't understand the distinction,
mm-hmm. you're good. A human being.
I gave a TED talk to you, and that's fine.
Yeah, no, it's totally fine. Harvard Extension School. It's fine. Go ahead.
I was at the big one in Vancouver. Yeah. And you know who else was there? Bill Ackman and Barry Weiss. Oh. And some other really fine people. I had some great conversations, but Bill Ackman and Barry Weiss were both giving talks there. Also Scott Galloway. But interestingly, at TED this past year, they were giving talks in the midst of this weird setup and programming. I think there was Section 7, and they were called the Provocateurs. They essentially had a ghetto.
It's roping them off, yeah.
These dangerous presentations. But Barry proceeded to give what I thought, and I've heard Barry talk a bunch of times before, like one of her best talks ever during that TED. And it was great precisely because 99% of the things that she said during that talk, completely inoffensive, innocuous things, a couple of bars in there. And the rejoinder was, when did this all become completely unacceptable for people to believe or say without being castigated as the worst kind of monsters? That her talk was great. The surrounding context was actually just kind of bizarre. I think credit again to Ted for a second year in a row, making certain to have people like Barry show up and talk there and be real participants in the event. They need it desperately. Given the ideological bent of the institution, and that's not just
particularly
because of my
after
politics.
They published Coleman's piece saying, you know, Ted screwed me over, and that was published in the Free Press.
She mentioned Coleman from the stage. Ted definitely knows what people are going to say before they get up there and say it, and they had her participate anyway. Yeah. So again, credit to them. Totally. I think less good is just the way that they're going about this. I don't think giving them a ghetto that is sort of prominently labeled as, you know, these ideas, you're probably going to disagree, but we need to hear them out. They don't do that. And at the end of her talk, you don't necessarily want to go on stage and provide this kind of counterpoint to what the presentation that just went on.
Is that what happened?
Subtly, it kind of, I mean, again, Chris, to his credit, like takes the stage.
Chris Anderson,
and he
former editor of Wired, but the head of TED.
I can't, but they're not the same person.
They're not
right?
the same person.
That's true.
it's
not
rough.
The same person. Not the same person.
The Wired Chris is the good one.
But
okay.
Well, I think there's a fair chance that they're both good. But here I would offer a little bit of criticism of Chris because he took to the stage, he's talking with Barry. Again, he's being generous and complimentary and insisting that there's common ground in certain ways. But he also goes on to say, effectively, is it possible to have this disagreement in love? Don't you understand, or can you at least recognize that certain people feel like fear and threatened by the fact that you ostensibly have a different opinion than them? Is it possible to disagree in love? And it just seems to me that neither Barry nor any of the people who attended the conference and who were excited to hear her talk lack the capacity to empathize with people who disagree with them. On the other hand, like a lot of the TED staffers, and not the attendees, because I talked to lots and lots of them, and they are not psychopaths. But a lot of the staffers, on the other hand, actually need to hear that message. Mm-hmm. Like the people who imagine that the best thing to do when you hear Barry Weiss is giving a talk is resign or throw fits in your private signal chats. Like, you people are the problem. And it's a pity that that kind of thing is just so potent at TED. And the last thing I'll say, land acknowledgements and all sorts of other weird political catechisms. Endemic.
Really?
Endemic. It was so weird. And they would show up in the oddest places, like a denunciation of colonizers in the middle of your presentation about storing data inside of wheat. I don't understand what you're doing.
That's here. Amazing.
Like, we're gonna use the bananas. We're gonna program data into the bananas because that's what the colonizers brought here. That's the crop, and it's gonna be, you know, ancient indigenous wisdom. It was absolutely bonkers. And the phrase I heard that, like, really, really left me scratching my chin afterwards and just wanting to punch someone in the face was, let all stolen lands be returned to their original owners in our lifetimes.
Let's do it.
Who's
the original owner? Let me trace that one back.
This is a wonderful question. It just, the land acknowledgement is the most bizarre modern phenomena, imaginable. And I think I'm going to start doing public talks where I provide like a historically accurate land acknowledgement before I start talking any place publicly.
Like, do you know what's
like human history?
Some listeners,
human history is replete with unadulterated savagery. Slavery and subjugation have been the norm throughout history. So there is unequivocally and incontrovertibly no stupid, idiotic claim to land that I'm going to respect.
Yeah.
Older than a couple hundred years ago. And maybe let's just draw a line and say, if it was written before the Constitution of the United States, I probably don't have any respect for it.
What if they did that for Israel and they went back and they were like, you know what? I guess the Jews have it. I mean, that's probably theirs. I mean, we went back because the ultimate land acknowledgement might be the Jews. Some listener can do this because I don't know. It gets dicey there. I don't know if I could find this, but there was an episode of this podcast in which someone mentioned land acknowledgements and I had never heard of them. It was a long time ago. And I was like, wait, you're kidding me, right? And that was, and now it's like, oh yeah, of course. I mean,
it's everywhere.
They do them at schools and, you know, like very rich person private schools, they do land acknowledgements. But the great thing about this is I love when it reminds me, and I might have mentioned this a long time ago, when I was at Newsweek, this was 2012, right? And Niall Ferguson, the historian, had written a cover story for Newsweek because Tina Brown liked to have different ideas, saying this is why you shouldn't vote for Barack Obama. And there were some errors in the piece, right? Now, everything that was published, there was always some errors in the piece, or there's stuff that, you know, you can slice it or dice it a few different ways. But there was such an uproar that this became like an issue, and there was people debating it and, you know, people writing about it. And as I pointed out at the time, if he had written that piece for National Review, no one cares. No one cares. You're like, oh yeah, well, whatever. Yeah. He's got it wrong, or, you know, whatever. Maybe they should get a correction. But that was still when people thought Newsweek is one of our institutions. You're not allowed to have that stuff in our institutions, which is why they treat Barry that way. This is why they treat other people like, oh, we like to have different ideas, because they actually don't like different ideas. So they're congratulating themselves for doing something really boring and normal, which is having a different view, which is what all these things should be about, because it precipitates good debate, you know, that kind of thing. But it's the cultishness of it is so hilarious to me. And land acknowledgements are one aspect of that. If you look at Wild Wild Country or any of these documentaries about 70s cults, you know, this was like, imagine that in the largest scale possible, in which people are saying things and they don't even know. Maybe they privately talk, you know, when the lights go out in the commune, like, is he having sex with everybody? Because I think this is something weird going on here. Is the leader, is he just trying to fuck us all? Because
the answer is always
weird.
Yes.
The answer is always yes, right? And I don't know who the person is in this analogy, but that kind of thing is what you get when people tell you at TED privately, like, oh, yeah, it's a bit weird, isn't it? But nobody wants to publicly say anything because there's a public shame element to it that you just kind of go along with the cult, right? There's always people within the cult that are like, this has gotten too weird. This is getting a little scary and dangerous. And you get those people that send us messages in this podcast. It's like, it's so bizarre that this is the stuff that I have to deal with in my own media organization. Like if you look at, and we talked about when you were in here, Camille, we talked about that NPR piece that the Free Press ran of Uri Berliner's thing. Was like,
yeah,
the response was everyone internally, like, you know, sanctioning him, which I actually understood because you shouldn't do that to your own company. But the crazy thing about it is there were people that signed, like 80 of them, 100 of them signed a petition like, this guy's bad. He's wrong and he's bad. And he ended up leaving because of it. It's like, don't step out of line. And that is somebody who's trying to deal with the fact that, you know, which I think is really interesting about the past, like 5 years, I would say, when people are kind of realizing, waking up to this stuff. At the end of the day, there's issues like Ukraine, there's issues like Israel, and then all the people that were kind of allies before on these issues are like, wait, we don't agree on this stuff. It's like, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, no, we're sensible together on things like speech and things like, you know, allowing people to have, you know, what is a totally abused word of heterodox opinions and allowing them within your institution. But at the end of the day, we are the people that agree on that. But no, we don't agree on Ukraine. We don't agree on Israel. We don't agree on a bunch of other things, you know, economic policy. So yeah, that's the funny thing to watch all this stuff. Like you said, Zed Jelani, who I think he followed me because he appears to have unfollowed me on Twitter, but doesn't surprise me because we disagree on probably this one big issue to him. So
I'm stuck on the word provocateur as a category here.
Ridiculous.
Because it says something about the people doing the naming. It is that if you hold a couple of views or frequently hold views that are contrary to what we all assume that the majority of this institution, and it could be a allegedly fact, you know, based institution that is not expressly political. But if that person does that often enough, they're provoking. I mean, I understand that Barry. I would use controversialist with Barry because not only does she say things that are not in that mainstream, but she likes to. she likes to jump into the burning building and dance around.
Save cats.
I get that, and that's fine. It's part of her personality and success. But to say that someone is provoking, Scott Galloway is provoking you, how?
Yeah,
by woofing.
I mean, he. I don't think he was particularly provocative. I mean, he did say that, you know, he talked about fatness and you're not like being body positive. You're like about to fucking kill yourself by overeating. So stop being a fat ass. Like that's the kind of thing he said.
Can you believe that's controversial? That's amazing.
He could sort of be it.
But the rest of the ideas were all really conventional, like political recommendations. In fact, in the same block, Andrew Yang, and I should add this context, Andrew Yang gives a talk about, you know, rank choice voting. And I don't think that's particularly provocative.
No.
But, you know, and I think Avi Loeb talked about UFOs and how that space rock is definitely a UFO. Again, is that provocative? I don't know.
No,
it felt pretty clearly designed to be the right place for Bill Ackman and Barry, who both appeared in the same block.
I mean,
well, one thing about Barry, and people like Barry say, you know, she's a provocateur or whatever. And, you know, I've known her for a very long time, but that was not the person that I knew many, many years ago. And what ends up happening is you go out there, you put your head above the parapet and you want to say things that are pretty normal and, you know, defend positions that are pretty normal. Like Tom Cotton publishing an op-ed was like, are you kidding me? And then when everyone attacks you and makes you a hate figure, the greatest thing for you to do at that point is to embrace it and just, you know, be that vessel of ideas. Because like, what does it matter at this point? There's so many people that I know that are like on the precipice and they still want to keep their, you know, entry points to the mainstream and not become the person. Like Jesse Singles, another great example of this. You know, somebody who's like, was it New York Magazine, was it Daily Beast? I think we might have even overlapped there for a minute. And then was like so unfairly maligned and hated that he's just like, fuck it. I'm going to, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, and I'm not going to back off on anything that I believe is true. And that is something that is a great demerit to people like me who have for years, like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't say that. And now that I have, you know, this as my main kind of job is that, you know, I don't feel constrained anymore. And I should have not felt constrained before. And that's an enormous, enormous you know, demerit to me. That's like a, that's something that I'm kind of ashamed of in a way. That I was like, I have a kid, she goes to school, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go rock the boat too much, and maybe I'll say this and that. And, you know, when you get to a point in which everyone's decided you are a certain thing, it is actually kind of liberating. Because then you can just say whatever the fuck you want, you know? Like, you no longer have to straddle these lines of like, oh, what can I say that's acceptable in the mainstream?
I mean, as ever for me, shout out to my primary employer who has managed to not fire me for 20 years. And even allowed me to run the magazine for a while.
Editor at large.
Yeah. Fake job. Mean, it's a fake job, for sure.
It's total fake.
But with the understanding that I'm going to say things here specifically and elsewhere, including sometimes in the pages of Reason, that the majority of the people at Reason, the majority of the readers are going to go like, what? No. Like the column I wrote that,
socialism's not so bad
in France.
The French healthcare piece was
a close one.
Among Matt Welch's worst.
It was fantastic. I was totally correct about everything again. No, that is freeing up. It's really hard in all of those things to avoid the temptation of defining one's self and choosing one's actions in reaction to people, which is one of the reasons why I always rejected the word, the kind of self moniker of heterodox thinkers. It's like, I don't want, and it's fine.
Yeah.
Other people can use it. Let's do what they want. But just for me, like, I don't want to be defined as even a centrist, although I'm kind of centristy in certain ways, because then you're just defining yourself as a position in between some pole on your left and some pole on your right. And like,
which is always shifting too.
Which is always shifting. I mean, you should, the ideal like intellectual spot, and that's not calling myself one, but just the ideal place to be if you're commenting about the world and interacting with it, is to not give a shit and just of what anybody thinks of you, and to have the courage of your convictions and also follow power. And this is something to bring it around to what Zay Gilani was talking about that I kind of agree with him on, in that. And this is consistent, whether it's Tea Party or Columbia, is that it's always easy to find, to do some nut picking, to find the crazy people who are protesting or acting like fools in service of some idea or whatnot. I've always trying to remind myself of who is in power. An example, and what are they doing? And sometimes that is more instructive than where, you know, the discourse is at any given point. And there were a couple of examples of that just this fucking week or last week on Fridays, when the Biden administration rewrote Title IX guidelines about how campus sexual assault accusations should be adjudicated, basically reverted them back to this really awful due process stamping on standard that the Obama administration had done with the help of Joe Biden back in the day, and which we've talked about on this program, I think both with Greg Lukianoff, but also spectacularly with Laura Bazelon, and, you know, Emily Off and other people have written really great about it. Kathy Young for Reason during my tenure. It's really awful. It's like a fundamental due process thing that people, normal people, should all fucking care about. And it is, they're now creating something that's going to create injustice. And this might be more important than a vibe shift about discourse in which it seems like woke is going away. Those vibe shifts are important, but power is still being wielded in really, really awful ways. And we're also going to see this in a matter of mere moments, I think, also with the restoration of net neutrality. What are these zombie policies that no one's even chaining themselves to the freeway over anymore?
Because of the past 4 or 5 years, the internet has become incredibly less free because of net neutrality. Final point on this, by the way, is a very quick thing, is I don't consider myself heterodox for one reason, is that if you look at polling, my views are very normal. They're normal views. Heterodox to who? The media? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But to the American people, I'm pretty much in the middle, actually, of a lot of these things. And that middle shifts. Sure. What's that?
Do the American people like hockey?
No, but I want men playing in women's leagues. That's where I'm right in the middle.
Whoa.
That's where I just, if Leah Thomas was a NHL.
What is wrong with you?
I'm saying I want them to play. I want Leah Thomas to play on the women's team. And I want everyone, she's got to learn how to skate for us, but that's, we have to start there. But no, that is the thing that's crazy. Like, particularly when you talk, I mean, trans actually stuff is a really interesting one, because most people are like, you know, there's a couple of genders and we want to treat everybody fairly, but this seems kind of unfair. And this, it's not a crazy, like, it's a normal position for people to have. I mean, the same thing has always been true of affirmative action. I mean, you know, the majority, I mean, the number of black respondents who are opposed to affirmative action is always, for people in the mainstream, shockingly high. But, you know, this is, you know, and these are normal positions, and we allow the people who control the levers of power and the levers of, you know, communication to set what is normal. That's when they're saying, like, I cannot believe so many people, so many Hispanic people are supporting Donald Trump. We're almost up to 60%. It's like, yeah, yeah, because you don't pay attention and you're telling us what you believe the center to be. And the center is actually somewhere totally different. So don't call yourself heterodox, because most of your views are probably, if you listen to this podcast, right somewhere in the middle with where everybody else in America is.
We're the normal people.
We need to save some time.
What the fuck?
normal people.
No, yeah. I mean,
not people who not. Are like, I mean, you know what, a member state of the United Nations has to be destroyed. Is it like, that's a not a normal thing to want to destroy an entire country, to say it should be wiped off the map. I mean, that's kind of crazy.
That's crazy.
I mean, I'm not going to take issue with any particular policy you just talked about, but I do want to say I'm not normal. I mean, I'm exemplary.
I'm talking about myself. So, you're a complete fucking freak, but that's,
I'm the best. Yeah. Yes.
You, if you had your way, we'd all be living on oil derricks in like trading fucking beaver pelts or something.
I mean, I don't understand why any of that should be objectionable to anyone. Speaking of unpopular things, and I don't know that we should necessarily transition to this, but this just kind of came to my attention a little while ago, and I want to share it with you. The TikTok ban just passed the Senate.
Yeah.
Forced divestiture.
I've learned from the Hill, that a majority of black voters oppose bill to ban TikTok. Now, I don't know if you guys knew that, but clearly this is very important. As I understand it, most voters are not particularly hot on this issue, but it won pretty big in Congress, began in the House, and was attached to Ukraine war funding. So there are some reasons why it won, but it also seems to be the case that there are lots and lots of politicians who are enthusiastic about this. As we've talked about before, Donald Trump has reversed himself on this matter. Joe Biden is very excited about it. And to the extent there are specific criticisms that one can lob at this particular piece of legislation, the thing to keep in mind from my standpoint is that it gives the president of the United States, whoever he happens to be, a lot of new, somewhat arbitrary authority to designate various apps as potentially problematic and to engage in some sort of regulatory action. Whether or not this is a speech issue, we can debate that. But I think that for sure is something to be a little concerned about if you care at all about abuses of executive power. If you're worried about, say, Donald Trump getting elected.
Can I interrupt you very quickly? Uh-oh. We play a game on this show. And we did it last time with the Vision Pro. And you said this time that there was a shocking study that black Americans are opposed to TikTok ban. So I did, very quickly while you were talking, I did our favorite game on the show. And I came up very quickly with two headlines. Oh, this one is from CNN.
Yes.
Asian Americans are anxious about hate crimes. TikTok ban rhetoric isn't helping. I don't know what that means. in your position, Representative Jamal Bowman blasts efforts to ban TikTok as racist. Ding, ding, ding. We win. It's every time we can squeeze it, we'll find a story about it. Send us your ideas. And we just did it for TikTok ban. So go ahead, Camille.
Wow. Well, that's all I've got on the TikTok ban. I don't know if you gentlemen have strong perspectives on any of this at the moment, but
I've always been, and you know, I'm obviously the techno idiot of the three of us, so I don't really understand how the system of tubes works. I've always been a little bit skeptical of what the harm is going to be. Of having the red Chinese own our daughter's, you know, scrolling history. It sounds bad. Certainly sounds terrible, like, for that to be true. And I hate TikTok. And I hate it for its attention spans. I used to like it for, like, especially when the kids couldn't go to school because of COVID. It was the way for them to, like, do dances and stuff and send it to each other. Fine. And you know, there's some creative editing that goes into it. Okay, that's all right too. But generally, you know, just like phones and teenagers and stuff, it's all kind of terrible. But I had a hard time, like, okay, what is the thing? I mean, we talked about Scott Galloway. I was on the Bill Maher show with him, and he's like, we're conducting the most severe scientific experiment in the history of mankind, unprecedented. You know, what happens when you put this phone in front of a bunch of 15-year-old girls and let the red Chinese, he didn't say red, I don't think, control their minds.
I think he said exactly the same thing during his TED Talk.
Yeah, it's a bugaboo of his, and Maher, of course, loves that, and other people too, especially on right and left in American political discourse. And again, sounds bad. It sort of seems plausible. It's something that definitely no one gives a flying fuck about outside of the corridors of power and media. I'm pretty sure. I could be wrong about that, but
hence the popularity of TikTok,
because people like to use TikTok. Just what is the mechanism of power? And people will also point to, well, content on TikTok has been overwhelmingly anti-Israel in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I know a lot of Israelis are very keen to point that out, and there's studies that show that, and they also on other types of a couple of other big issues, certainly anything involving China, that the content seems to be skewed. Let's grant that that's possible, even though it's also possible that things being used by young people are going to reflect where young people are at on issues, and that it is actually kind of true on Israel-Palestine. But all of that, it's hard for me to understand what the harm is going to be. It sounds like plausible, ooga booga man, but kind of hard to see. At the on the other hand of it, like forcing ByteDance to sell to somebody else, for me, it's not ideal, because it's sort of, that every totalitarian government or just authoritarian government is going to use this as an excuse to tell Apple that it can't do WhatsApp in China, which is happening ongoing. Russia is going to ban YouTube probably at some point. The era of a global open internet, which was something that people cared a lot about 10, 15 years ago, talked about it a lot during the Arab Spring, for example, vis-a-vis Twitter, that era seems to be behind us, and it's part of the kind of overall collapsing of neoliberal ideas. And I lament that in a broad way. It's possible that this won't matter too much. I'm hoping that this won't matter too much. And maybe we forestalled a red Chinese bad thing happening. Certainly I hate the red Chinese, so that's fine. So maybe we dodged a bullet in doing it. I just have never been convinced by people's arguments of what that bullet would look like.
Black creators built TikTok, but black employees say they experienced toxicity and racism. Which also led me to a headline on Nickelodeon. Where would we be without black women inventors? I don't know. I mean, like, it's so weird. I'm like, what a weird way of looking at life.
I watched so
incredibly stupid.
I watched a documentary last night called Brandy Hellville.
About Brandy Melville?
The Brandy Melville doc. I watched the first 5 minutes.
It was
that.
Just as bad as the first 5 minutes promised. A dark history of anti-Semitism and racism and colonialism and slavery. And it's
Brandy Melville was colonizer?
Absolutely, because it's a Swiss guy.
Explain that to me. Because my daughter and I have gone there.
Yeah.
The only thing I know about is they don't have sizes, which is very fat-shaming, I guess.
Brandy Melville makes clothing for young girls.
Yes.
That's what they do. It's a fast fashion brand. It's like Zara or Gap or whatever, except there's a weird affection for Ayn Rand, which I think we've talked about on the podcast.
I'd forgotten that. So that was a weird moment when suddenly there's like a John Galt sub brand within it. And it's like, what?
Yeah.
And
it's all over the
guy self-identifies as a libertarian. Of course, immediately right after they go through the libertarian thing, they go into like his, executive private WhatsApp group, which is just sharing Hitler images. And it's like, God damn it. Why do we have to go from libertarians to Hitler in 35 seconds?
I didn't watch that part.
Did they really call Brandy Melville a colonizer?
It's part of the system. What has been true About the fashion industry since its inception, but to the modern day, is that it's built on female and mostly minority female labor and usually slave labor. And that continues. The legacies of colonialism are with us to this day, and slavery are part of the system even as we speak today. And part of that,
it's literally 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but like for colonialism and slavery,
the argument,
like you can get anything back to that, but
the argument is that
weird way of looking at the world,
the fast fashion stuff after it inevitably rips when you wash it for the second time in the washing machine, people dump it. And then those secondhand and thirdhand clothes all end up in Ghana. And so they had some pretty...
So the people in Ghana look like 16-year-old sluts. What is the idea there?
Well, it's that was a problem because it's clothes from everywhere and not just Brandy Melville. So they had to sort of like, it's mostly, they're just like really bad.
So
like,
they're opposed
supersonic
to
shoots.
People having clothes?
Well, it's just that it's there's so much of it that it pollutes the beach. They showed beaches at the beach and it's actually shocking of just like the beach is covered with used t-shirts. And it's like it gets in the water, and that is a sign of colonialism because we're dumping our trash, our unsustainable consumer habits are choking the babies of the third world.
So it's essentially like an undergraduate argument.
Worse.
And they
have this one reporter that they came out, I forget where she was from, I think Insider or something. And you could tell it was a problem because they would go to her and she would say, and that's when I started doing research. I started looking for any lawsuit that Brandy Melville had been involved in. It's like her clackety clack, looking for a lawsuit. It's like, oh boy, this is
my favorite B-roll.
This is
going to
be thrilling.
Some 28-year-old looking through Pacer to find if there's been a lawsuit.
It's amazing that they happened to be there to catch her doing that actual thing.
And in this lawsuit, they were accused of racism and they denied it. And we don't know what happened. Don't know what happened with the lawsuit.
That's the Tesla that's one amazing. That comes up all the time too.
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
You know, provided you, it's you know the legacy of Me Too. Do you remember that was like only if you've only been accused, that's pretty much all that has. Just make the accusation and you're fine. And that's the thing is like someone once said. I mean, that was the thing I just read about TikTok. Like a black employee at ByteDance said people were like not nice to me, and therefore it's like, do you understand that TikTok? It's not about. They're scraping your kids' data. It's about that they're racist. I'm like, really? Are they? The Chinese guys are racist towards black people?
Oh, my gosh.
Makes a certain amount of sense.
Probably.
I think they're usually are.
The allegation is everything. There's literally nothing you can do after the allegation is made. If you defend yourself, racism. If you say nothing, obviously racism. If you pay the money just to try to make this go away, clearly you admitted that you are racist. The worst thing, maybe the best thing you could do is just say, oh yeah, we're super racist.
Yeah.
Like we're racist.
We are actually a racist.
We're sorry.
Yeah.
Everything we do is actually racist.
Yeah, Brandy Melville was actually a cousin of Ava Braun, and that's where the name comes from. But yeah, but the accusation's everything, provided you're not an Israeli woman who was kidnapped on October 7th.
Too soon.
Or murdered on October
7th. We need video evidence. Yeah, we need to take some swabs.
Until then.
Yeah. It's funny, I'm thinking about, well, I don't know. Because we've been going for about an hour. We need to make some time for CJ. And I sent you guys a link to a story in The Guardian about the other most important thing that's happening this week. And it's the Drake-Kendrick Lamar beef.
Yeah, I didn't click on that link, by the way.
I don't understand why you did.
I don't know who those people are.
Kanye dropped a new song with Future. And it is another installment in this beef. And these are probably Kanye's best bars in a very long time. Same thing for Drake. So the whole thing is somewhat fun to watch, but I believe the opening lyrics are kind of an ode to, not kind of, they are an ode to P. Diddy. He explains that he is having sexual intercourse with your girlfriend in a Sean John tank top, which
I wasn't aware of that. Let me go ask her.
At its most.
See if that's true.
I'm sure she appreciates the upgrade.
But I don't know if there's other important stuff for us to talk about this week before we get into the thing with CJ.
No, I think that probably covers it.
All right.
That probably covers
it. Not that this isn't important. This is important. Dude, this is an issue near and dear to my heart. So I'm desperate to have this conversation.
Really important.
At what age
really
are you supposed to...
That Sean John and all these people have been arrested by the police. I don't know what's happening.
When do you age out
but
of
I'm sure
beefs?
He's fucking guilty.
Like, is like 53 Do you stop having beef? I know Eminem was still beefing with someone. I think he's my age. It yeah. seems like it seems a little juvenile to be having.
Yeah, but Matt,
it's kind of silly.
It's kind of silly, but these are very popular people. And we at the Fifth Column would be incredibly popular if we, I mean, we're popular already. That's obviously true. Mm-hmm. We'd be very popular if we started beefing, like in the way that Candace Owens does, where she's discovered all these war crimes the Americans participated in World War II. And she's going out and being like, you know what? I think we were the bad guy. I think we were actually the bad guys. And then somebody in the response, like the beneath by this tweet of hers, which I'm kind of obsessed with, was like a string of the most like just raw anti-Semitism. I'm not like, this stuff isn't marginal. Like this is raw anti-Semitism. And there was a link to a video from Nick Fuentes, who is some sort of Hispanic Nazi. But he said
who refuses to have sex, by the way.
No, no, because it's like, that's he said. He said we put it's it
super gay.
Yeah, we put it
super
in the podcast.
Gay to have sex with girls.
We put that audio in the podcast when he was convinced me that my that any sort of fallow period that I had was me being super heterosexual, actually. but there's a video of him, and he's like, you know, you got to find this. It's like I cannot believe. Like people are like, this is an amazing bit of oratory from him. And he's like, you know, if you look at World War II, you know, who are the winners? We didn't win. We didn't win the World War II. Did the Russians win? They didn't win. He says the Jews were the winners.
What?
And I'm like, oh, I'm not joking. Monsters. And he's like, yeah, they had the influence after a like legitimate genocide, not one of these ones that it's good for cable TV to say genocide, but like an actual genocide. And it's like, yeah, they were the winners. And I'm like, oh, I'm glad that you're keeping company with these types of people. Well, maybe she's not. I have
whatever
no idea
else,
her friends. I shouldn't say that.
No, I think they have some sort of weird, complicated relationship, but are probably getting to become friends. I think it's important to acknowledge that people have been really fucking stupid throughout history.
Yes.
And most people have believed even dumber things than this for most of history. I don't know that we are in an unusually stupid era. It does feel like it sometimes, though.
Camille, so, we're not in an era of misinformation, bad information only. We are in an era of misplaced confidence. We have a confidence crisis. People find something on the internet like Candace Owen, and she's like, oh, nobody knows about this. And they're suppressing conversation about Dresden. I have like 9 books on my bookshelf about Dresden. None of them are like, that was fucking awesome. Like, what are you talking about? Like, this is confidence, and you have to get rid of that confidence, and then you'll realize that you're actually a fucking moron. So there you go.
Yes, bye. That's why we're here.
Of misplaced.
That's why
confidence.
We're here.
I like that.
That's
you
very
get,
good.
You get one.
That's very good. That should go on a t-shirt.
Yeah. The crisis of confidence is not that you have too little of it; it's that you have too much.
I got it.
Yeah.
I got it.
Just making sure.
As he was saying.
All right.
Okay.
Well, we're gonna put a button in this. Yeah. Next thing you hear is us talking to CJ, and I keep saying CJ because his last name is literally unpronounceable.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not even going to pretend, and I get everyone's last name wrong, but I'm not even going to attempt this. It's bad.
It's pronounced CJ is a spicy meatball. That's it. Yeah.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
For now.
Bye.
For now.
We know of new methods of attack.
I was just telling Matt about this while you were taking calls from friends of yours and not being on the podcast.
Friends of ours. Friends of ours.
Whatever, but I wouldn't take a call right now. That there was a gas leak in the house. I mean, I was in a meeting and then the whole house smelled like gas. So if it goes up, if you see a blinding flash of Dresden-like light...
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Please call Candace Owens and say they're attacking Christians again. Just like 1945. They're coming after us because we're Christians. Because the British, by the way, were not Protestants. Like you know, Dresden, a Protestant city. Definitely was not the case when the Nazis were bombing them. And I'll have more on this for the people because this is an area of a little bit of expertise for me. And it's really pissing me off. So I might just sit in front of a mic and bitch about how people misunderstand this and how this is a gateway to Nazism when you call Dresden a Holocaust. It's not this amazing. This fucking unbelievable idiot that she is. Anyway,
did you just
let's start
the podcast. Michael, we love firebombings. Moynihan. There it is.
I mean, only if it's Nazis. I don't like firebombing anyone but Nazis. I love bombing Nazis. So, for the record.
We should probably introduce our guest because in a week where the the guy who wants to be president of the United States, who was once president of the United States, finds himself being criminally prosecuted in New York. And mm-hmm. Tesla, the most exciting American company in a generation, is undergoing all sorts of turmoil, probably going to fail. TikTok has been banned. Bunch of money for the Ukrainians. All sorts of important news. But we know that we need to start in the two most important places, mm-hmm. The Drake, Kendrick Lamar beef, and also the fucking Adderall crisis. Are.
Yeah, that's important.
The Adderall crisis.
Do you think going to Joe Biden? Because he seems to be on it sometimes, then other times he's not getting it.
How do you think the State of the Union came off this time around, right? That's hoarding. That's some wartime hoarding.
I mean, we need to talk about this. If you were a longtime listener to this podcast, you know that Adderall is a drug, also known as legal meth. Fucking Adderall is important to us. We depend on it.
His attention just diverted by a noise. Yeah. Adderall is really... Where's that squirrel? Noise. My God, did you see the squirrel?
There's a really loud noise in this room.
Someone can't get their prescription filled.
Well, no, this is the actual problem. The last time I had it filled was some time ago. I sent you gentlemen a picture today of my last 10 milligram tab, which I was just about to split in half and take. Mm. And the reasons for this are somewhat mysterious and terrible, but certainly have something to do with the government. And we called in a ringer to help explain the situation to us and to help us navigate our complicated feelings about all this. CJ, I don't want to butcher your name, the pronunciation of it. I could, because it's kind of a thing on the podcast. Why don't you tell us how to pronounce your last name? And by us, I mean me. And let's talk about this fabulous piece, which, again, hit very close to home for me. The first couple graphs where you describe your ruinous life, like, yeah, just how miserable things were before drugs came into your life to make it better. I can relate in such an intimate way to all of that. I feel somewhat naked. Like, that is totally my story.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on. The last name, it's probably best if I do this, is Saramella. It's a little
holy
bit.
Holy shit. No. Yeah, I wasn't going to do that at all. I mean,
I've been running with Charamella.
It was weird before you came on. Camille said, I don't know how to pronounce it, but he is a greaseball. And I was like, that's racist. Couldn't believe. Racist. Yeah, as a half Italian myself, I was a little offended by that. But yeah.
Well, I'm pretty sure Italians aren't a race, but whatever.
Yes, we are.
Very proud. Very proud people. Very like 1939 Life magazine wrote that Joe DiMaggio, to his credit, didn't reek of garlic. So
I mean,
come a long way.
The thing about that is Dom DiMaggio, his brother did, by the way, but to his credit, that is actually true about Joe DiMaggio, which is why he married Marilyn Monroe. That's when we became white, by the way.
I love, actually, that would be one hell of a history book, when we became white.
There's a book called When the Irish Became White, because that's the other part of me. The other knuckle-dragging European species, half Irish, half Italian. So, and there's, if you go back to Puck magazine in particular, I think it was Puck that published all these cartoons of the Irish as monkeys and such. But we won't get off on CJ's racial deficiencies, and we'll send mine too. And we'll start by saying that, yes, indeed, CJ wrote a piece about this Adderall shortage, which has been going on for so long now, and it is impossible to find Adderall if you prescribed it in the appropriate way, which, you know, some of us are. And as I said to Camille today, I sent him some screenshots from Craigslist, which has a thriving black market in study aids, which various euphemisms to find them, and they're pulled pretty quickly. But there's a big black market. CJ, why is there such an insane Adderall shortage?
Yeah,
so
it's going on about 2 years now. I think it's been about 18 months since the government officially declared a shortage, which means it's probably been going on longer. Anyone who takes ADHD medication or is using narcolepsy as well, stimulants, anyone who has a kid who is prescribed this knows that it's been extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get your prescription filled, or you have to spend a bunch of time trying to switch around and find what's in stock. It's been a nightmare. It's been going on. There's a bunch of blame, a bunch of finger pointing going on. The DEA and the FDA say that drug manufacturers haven't been hitting their quota for manufacturing the stimulants used in Adderall and Ritalin and stuff like that. But these companies also say that, you know, ADHD diagnosis.
Camille, you might want to mute your mic there. It sounded like a jet engine just went
fly
off.
By.
Okay. And maybe solve that. Sorry, CJ, continue. We'll cut that out.
The DEA, during COVID, ADHD diagnoses really went through the roof after the DEA loosened the rules around telehealth prescriptions. Mm-hmm. They went up about, I think, 13 or 14% over the last year, or between like 2019 and 2022, I think. But the DEA did not increase its production quotas. So there was a massive rise in demand without any corresponding rise in supply. And all of a sudden, the DEA is very concerned about this. It's like, well, I think we might have a DEA official just recently said last week that he saw the warning signs of a drug epidemic similar to the opioid crisis in the rise in demand for Adderall.
Of course.
Like, you created their shortage, and now you're saying that because of the rise in demand, it's a problem.
Well, two questions here we need answered. Number one is, why does the DEA have quotas on this for the average person? That probably seems a bit odd. If there's an increase in demand coming from doctors, then people should be able to produce that, one would imagine. And number two, has anyone died of an Adderall overdose? Like, you know, opioids, we have a number of deaths we can point to, but this is not the case, I don't think, with Adderall. Are there any deaths on record from Adderall?
I don't know that off the top of my head. I'm guessing there's probably someone out there who railed too much Adderall and had a heart attack. But you know, I like the main side effect of abusing, you know, prescription stimulants seems to be getting a college degree. which is why I don't have one, in fact.
Which is what the government is also encouraging, that everyone should get a college degree.
So I mean, really getting mixed messages here.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's there's, you know, it, unlike opioids, there's not a huge epidemic of people keeling over because they are you know, abusing prescription stimulants. Another thing the DEA is worried about is counterfeit Adderall pills that are now starting to pop up, which, surprise, that's what happens when there's a shortage. You know?
Yes.
Sorry, that was the first question. What was the second question?
I think it was your piece that actually mentioned this, that there's a producer, I think on Long Island, who hasn't been able to produce for 2 years because they're being audited for 2 years by the government and cannot produce anything in that time.
Yeah, okay, your first question, I remember going back a little bit. The drug manufacturers, the DEA, sets these production quotas for controlled substances. And in this case, the stimulants that are used in Adderall and Ritalin are basically, like, I think we were joking around, pretty much like meth light. So they're amphetamine salts, mm-hmm. and the DEA regulates how much of those can be produced in the country because they're a controlled substance. They're a Schedule II substance. So if you're a drug manufacturer, the DEA tells you how much of this you can make a year. Well, there is a big drug manufacturer on Long Island that was making up to about 20% of the nation's supply of amphetamine salts for generic and prescription amphetamines. And the DEA shut them down because of record creeping discrepancies. There was a big New York Magazine investigation into this. And, you know, there was, you know, maybe there's legitimate concerns about what they were doing. The DEA is really paranoid right now. Part of the reason they're sounding the alarm on this is a lot of people blame the DEA for the opioid crisis and not doing more to stop, like, all these pills from flooding into Appalachia and all that. So now they don't want to get caught with their pants down with Adderall, even though, you know, as we discussed, it's not the sort of public health crisis that opioids are. So anyways, they start looking at the record keeping of this huge manufacturer, and they've been shut down for basically 2 years, not producing anything. I think in the article, one of the errors that the DEA flagged was on when a spreadsheet, you were supposed to cross out something and write canceled next to it, but the person only crossed it out and didn't write canceled. And that's the sort of thing they're, like, picking them apart for now. And so that's why, like, 20% of the nation's Adderall supply suddenly went missing. You know, stuff like that.
And the difficulties of this with government intervention and regulation of this stuff, and I think I've mentioned this on the show before, is that you're in New York State, let's just take New York State, where I live, you cannot get refills. which is an amazing feathering of the nest of doctors, because every time you want a refill, you have to go to the doctor and you have to pay a copay. And I've been told they used to like write the prescriptions in advance and you could do this and that and the other. Now there's no paper prescriptions anymore. It has to be electronically done. And the doctor said to me, like, look, I don't want to get in trouble. I have to see you every time if you want a refill of this, which means, you know, $20, $30 copay. You're talking an extra $300, $400 a year just for that. And then when it's sent out, because there's no refills, once it gets to a pharmacy, and if that pharmacy does not have it in stock, which is a very common thing in the past couple of years, you have to write an entirely new prescription. You cannot transfer that and find a pharmacy. So it makes for people who actually need these drugs and prescribe these things, and we're not, you know, college students on deadline, it makes it almost impossible. And so you can't find, there's no database who has this that doesn't exist. And once, you know, even if it's within the same network, so if it's Rite Aid or CVS, they cannot transfer it to another pharmacy. You have to go back to your doctor, wasting an enormous amount of time for doctors, as my doctor was telling me that, you know, he spends like, you know, half a day sometimes a week trying to fill these prescriptions that people have. And that's all because the government wants to regulate and control, and it's done nothing but create a mess that we've seen in every type of government drug policy over the past 100 years.
Yeah, part of the impetus for my piece was I had recently gone through the whole process of getting diagnosed and a prescription, so I had to do all this bullshit. My psychiatrist that I found, luckily, was a telehealth psychiatrist, was really patient and worked. You know, I called her up after a few weeks because my prescription wasn't getting filled, so she went and got another. She got me time-release Adderall, and that one was in stock. So she worked me. And then I found out that my insurance didn't even cover Adderall. You know, I called the pharmacy because they hadn't reached out to me. And they're like, oh, yeah, your insurance doesn't cover this. Most insurers don't want to cover adult ADHD. And so, you know, if I hadn't got like a coupon, it would have cost me about $200 out of pocket to get a 30-day supply of something, honestly, that like I need to help me be a functional adult. is insane. And now the DEA wants to restrict telehealth appointments so that you have to, if you get a prescription, they're proposing to do this, I think, that you have to do an in-person visit. You're not allowed to get a refill right. for telehealth, which will, I live in a remote area. I'm not going to be able, I'll have to find a new psychiatrist and start this whole thing over again. It's going to be awful. It's such an unnecessary mess.
It's also just the most bizarre relationship. I can remember going to see, first, the difficulty of finding a therapist who would essentially just be my Adderall hookup. But there was this whole stupid fucking kabuki that I had to deal with the entire time, where he would pretend to give a shit about my personal problems and start to ask me questions about how I'm doing, like, every single week. But the appointments are clearly 15 minutes long, and the expectation is very much, I pay you $300 to see you every single month, and you keep renewing my Adderall prescription. And that $350, no insurance doesn't cover it. Yes, insurance will cover my Adderall prescription. And that was before things got really, really insane. And for a while, I was using one of these mail order services up until very recently. Like, they actually filled a prescription via FedEx, and it came to my house. It was splendid. And that no longer seems to work. And I had been the guy who reliably had like three full bottles of Adderall at any time. And today, literally, I'm thinking about the last 5 milligrams I have. And what I most appreciate about your story, in addition to just giving us the facts about who is responsible for this shortage, like the very real human story of people who have had to struggle with ADHD and various other things, and the fact that these medications can actually be meaningfully beneficial to your life in a huge way is really important. And having to be forced to switch from short to long acting, to switch up your fucking dosage, to split pills imprecisely, it is absolutely insane that anyone dealing with like real tangible health issues finds themselves having to navigate all this. And I should take one beat to just say that I sing the praises of Adderall frequently. I should also inform anyone who is interested in this sort of thing that it is hardly a silver bullet, and you can totally abuse it and find yourself not fucking sleeping, and that is generally counterproductive. Having the Adderall and pairing it with a serious, strict mindfulness practice has been enormously beneficial for me. So there's a plug for Sam Harris's Waking Up app, which I should probably get an affiliate code so I can get some money, but is like the best money you will spend, dear listener, other than for your subscription to this fine podcast, which you can get at the Substack.com with the thing. You know how to find it. I don't know. You know the thing.
Well, it's one of these things that, you know, and I recommend people read CJ's piece to sort of see how this is being created by the government and not being created by natural market forces and, or, you know, or market failure or something like this, is that we have a number of things that exist today. Weed was one of them for a very long time, in which we presume that they're doing bad things to us, and the government just operates on this presumption, and people generally operate in this presumption. The other one is vaping. So vaping has now, I mean, I have talked to more people these days who tell me, I mean, this is very, very common, that vaping is worse than cigarette smoking, which is so deranged that I don't even know where to begin. And as I've mentioned many times in this show, a doctor, Michael Siegel, who was then at Boston University, I think is now at Tufts, who was a great opponent of the tobacco industry, told me that if every person on earth who is smoking started vaping today, would save millions of lives. But that message, of course, has been drowned out by, oh, there's kids, you know, have bubble gum vape and all these sorts of things. So we have to crack down on it. But the interesting thing in New York City is that flavored vapes were banned in New York. You couldn't get them. And then when the bootleg weed stores opened, you literally, if you went into any of these vape shops, all the vape shops closed, you went to these bodegas, they wouldn't have them. And they would ask you, like, you know, there's a few that did, and they would size you up and see if you were like an NYPD undercover guy. And I'm like, guys, look at me, seriously. But what happened was when all the weed stores opened up, they stopped caring. So every single bodega in the city now sells flavored vapes everywhere. And that was because all the weed stores just opened up with impunity and they decided to do, you know, they shut them down here and there. But I, you know, went for a walk about 20 minutes before we started, and I walked by two new vape stores in a residential neighborhood in Brooklyn that I hadn't seen before. And like that, after that happened, because we used to have that idea about weed, is that it's going to, you know, make you crazy. It's a gateway drug, all this stuff. We've given up on that and we've replaced it with things like Adderall and like vaping. That, where is the science that this is actually creating a public health crisis or destroying people? And not actually, in the case of Adderall, helping people. It's not as if, you know, vaping is not, it's helping people stop smoking, but is Adderall helping people live productive lives? Absolutely. And I know a number of people whose lives are becoming less productive and much more difficult because of this government intervention.
CJ, the thing I found most moving about your piece, I didn't realize what a fucking wreck you are. And it's, yeah. It's very,
Matt said we shouldn't have him on the show. I don't think he's doing well.
he's not fully together.
He's notified HR.
But I think most people,
some kind of meth junkie.
Yeah. I've always presumed that certainly Moynihan, but probably also Camille, were just doing this recreationally because they're fiends. But reading you, since you actually write, eloquently and on time, can you describe a little a bit of
that's ADHD, buddy?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's why we don't write on time.
Check your privilege, asshole.
I am, and it's awesome. I love being neuronormal. It's the fucking best.
Don't touch my ears.
You don't know when the garbage truck is coming. What day of the week the garbage truck comes. That's an amazing shorthand of this. Can you describe for those of us who are stupid and unfeeling and uncaring in our privilege, but who just assume this is something that happens to kids when they're 11 and they grow out of it. Can you? No, I mean, CJ wrote about that in his piece. There's this assumption that kids are prescribed, might be, you know, my brother was prescribed pre-Ritalin back in the old days because he was hyperactive, as they said. And no one really talks about that anymore because beer is a wonderful drug. But like there's an assumption that this is a childhood thing and not an adult thing. Can you explain to people who don't know that what is happening with adults and why this is necessary?
Sure.
How fucked up are you? Please be detailed in your description.
I'll get into it. Don't worry. So ADHD is really misunderstood, even among a lot of medical professionals. A lot of medical health centers, places like that, just don't focus on it, even though it's one of the most wide, one of the most common psychiatric conditions experienced. It's a neurological disorder. It's a developmental issue in the brain. Your brain just forms and works a little differently. And it's mainly, you know, people notice it. I read a great quote about this today from a doctor who studies ADHD a lot. He says that people notice it when you're a kid because a kid's ADHD bothers you. It's a problem for you when a kid has ADHD.
Yeah, that's right.
You don't notice as much in adults because adult ADHD bothers the person who has it. You know, it doesn't go away. ADHD changes as you get older, you know, and it can wax and wane in intensity. So, you know, people cope with it better as they get older and as they mature more and things like that happen. But it's not like a switch where all of a sudden you're like, oh, it's fine now. I'm not, you know, I'm not 12, so my brain's just normal now. And with adults, it creates, you know, it's, you know, you're not, well, some adults still have the hyperactive part of it, but, you know, it's just dealing with day-to-day stuff and your working memory. I like to think about it like, imagine a Tetris screen, you know, you have a certain number of rows and the blocks come down. If they get to the top, you lose. A normal person has that many number of blocks. A person with ADHD, or number of rows, a person with ADHD has like not as many rows to work with, and that's their that's their working memory. So there's less stuff you can jam in my brain that will stay there. And like one of the things I wrote about in my story was, you know, when my wife and I moved into a new house, I could not for the life of me remember what day the garbage truck came. It didn't matter how many times she told me, or, you know, and this went on for like a year and a half. And, you know, she was getting, my wife was getting pissed, you know, like legitimately pissed. She's like, what the fuck's your problem? You know, and not like that, but like, and I understood. I was like, listen, I don't know what to tell you. It just didn't stick in my head, you know? And that's part of the thing is, it's not like, not normal people will say, oh, I forget things all the time, or, you know, I'm a little scatterbrained. But for people with ADHD, their limited working memory just means that it literally goes in one ear and out the other. It doesn't stick at all.
Yeah, it's a very common thing that I think people misunderstand. And I mean, look, to add to that slightly is that we joke about this on the podcast a lot. We joke about, you know, the having our performance enhancing drugs and being the Jose Canseco and Mark McGuire of podcast world. But yes, there is, I mean, for me, it's been a real issue my entire life and a really, really bad issue. And you see it manifest itself in so many weird ways, which, you know, when all put together, make a certain amount of sense as a diagnosis. But the thing that I think people misunderstand, and, you know, I have the exact same thing. I mean, the technology has been really great for it. I mean, I have AirTags that are stuck on everything. I mean, it's just like, I forget things. I don't know where they are. I forget, you know, and I'm a diabetic too, because I'm a complete fucking wreck. Is that I don't literally don't remember if I've taken insulin 5 minutes ago before I eat. And sometimes it's not even processing for me and I take it again. And that's insanely dangerous. I mean, you can just overdose. So I have to constantly be, you know, aware of everything I'm doing when I notice that most people in life don't have to do that, or a majority of people don't have to do that. So the interesting thing to me is that because things are being overdiagnosed and because people are taking things for the wrong reasons, I mean, you know, we had Andrew Sullivan on the show and we've joked with him before about how he takes steroids. I mean, Andrew takes steroids because he's HIV positive and he has to take steroids as part of the regimen. But it doesn't mean that people in the gym aren't taking steroids for the wrong reason. I mean, people think that the overdiagnosis means that there's no diagnosis. That, yeah. Oh, it's just all, the whole thing is kind of a concoction of you know, the drug industry or people trying to get ahead or cheat in life. And it's like, no, it has changed my life in pretty significant ways over many, many years. I mean, this has been 20-odd years, probably over that, since I was, they were like, are you joking? Have you never read about this? I mean, you clearly, this is what's wrong with you. But then to Camille's point of going to doctors, you have to go through the whole rigmarole again because they feel this enormous amount of pressure from you know, government overseers that, like, I have to talk to you. I'm like, look, you can go back in the computer, I'm sure, and see that I've been prescribed this for 20-odd years. I mean, this is, maybe you can think I'm abusing it for 20 years, but I have kept the dosage very low. I am very resistant to having higher dosages and things like that. But the fact that there's no one that it seems to me, I mean, I could find one person because I read your piece and I was like, oh, finally someone's writing about this. And it was the Democrat from Virginia, Abigail Spanberger, who seems to be talking about this. But not many people in government are actually talking about this and saying, well, there's people that are needing this and you're creating the shortage and you're creating chaos in their life. That's what we're doing. We can actually change that. And she's talking, do you see any other people in the political arena that are actually taking up this issue? Because it seems to be, you get credit in the political arena for taking up issues that you're trying to save people's lives from these hideous drugs and hideous drug companies, particularly after you know, all of the opioid stuff and all these books that have been written about it, and people like Patrick Radden Keefe's book, which is actually quite good. But like, is there anyone that even wants to take this on?
Yeah, I was, before we hopped on here, I was looking through the latest Google news about the Adderall shortage and stuff like that. And no, I, you know, there was quotes from the FDA and DEA and blah, 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 but nothing came up about, you know, after my piece went up, I got emails from parents and stuff like that talking about how hard this is. And you'd think that somebody, some politician would recognize there are millions of families around this country who are outraged and like heartbroken because they're working so hard to get their children medicine, but nobody is doing anything about it. You know, it's like one thing, if I can't get my ADD pills, you know, that's my problem. And I'm pissed about that. But like, I got these emails from these parents and I'm like, you know, if I couldn't get pills for my child, I would be fucking furious. And I don't understand why no one's doing more about this, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if either of you have had this experience, because I know for me early on, like I probably took a much higher dosage than I ought to have. And I stayed there for a while because it was always so hard to get the drugs, in which case you start kind of splitting pills in all sorts of different ways. So if I've got a 40 and what I really need is 5, like I've split it into a fourth or even end up taking a half. And to the extent there are legitimate concerns, I mean, it's entirely relevant to be concerned about like blood pressure and cardiac issues involved with long-term use, especially at really high dosages. I mean, I've gotten like 20 and 30 milligram pills for most of my life, and that's almost certainly far more than I need. At this point, I'm literally taking a 5 milligram pill sometimes once in a day, and that will be completely sufficient for me. But for a long time, I stayed at that higher dosage. Funny, I am curious about that, but I'm also reminded now of the fact that, you know, I've got these two great kids who are almost certainly both ADHD.
It's genetic, so.
In fact, Leah like has all sorts of stuff in common with me with respect to like those habits and forgetting to do things. So I'm trying to teach her, like give her structure, and she hasn't been formally diagnosed, so she isn't on anything. But I mean, it is really a horrific situation to be in, to know that there are drugs that could help and you can't actually give them to your kid. And I've thought about that in recent days.
Yeah, so so much of a weird stigma about it too. Over the course of our lives, it's changed so much. I mean, like when I was a little kid, the big worry was like drugging your kids, because everyone was pretty, I think there was a legitimate worry about overdiagnosing kids, from boys from my generation, with ADHD. So there was a big stigma about giving your kids medicine. My parents really resisted when I was a kid putting me on Ritalin or Adderall. I tried it a couple times when I was a little kid, and I think I complained once and they just took me right off of it. You know, in retrospect, I think maybe I needed that. Maybe it would have helped me. But there's so much different, weird, overlapping social stigmas and policies that it's just a really awful for families trying to figure out what's best for their kids and what's best for them in this kind of situation.
Well, we'll let you go in a second, CJ, but a final question for you. And the one that I think that people listening to this who are actually going through this, and again, it's important to address it because I think it's undercounted the number of people who are actually going through this. I mean, I've had so many people who I've mentioned on the show have sent messages and say, oh yeah, it's horrible. I actually had a listener say, my son has this, he lives in New York City and here's the pharmacy he goes to. Tried that pharmacy, nothing. But you know, it's like an underground railroad of people trying to get you drugs. But We have spirituals. We have Adderall spirituals. I can't. And then I stop singing because I can't pay attention. But is there a way out of this? Do you see any resolution? I mean, obviously, if you're looking on Google News and no one's talking about it, nobody in the House or in the Senate are talking about this. Local politicians aren't talking about it. It's an issue that's like, yeah, we don't want to take up on behalf of these hideous drug addict students who are just trying to get good grades in their exams. I mean, is there any relief in sight? These things typically kind of have a way of sorting themselves out, but this one seems to be persistent.
Yeah, I mean, I think the DEA is going to, well, I'm not optimistic about the DEA's forthcoming telehealth regulations. I just saw something recently that like 10% fewer Adderall prescriptions were being filled recently. So it's definitely not getting better in the short term. The government just announced that this shortage was continuing. They're talking about supply chain issues. I do hope that like this will hopefully sort itself out sometime in the next year. But I think it's going to get worse for telehealth and worse for people in rural areas and things like that. I honestly don't think it's going to get better unless a lot of these people and families really start speaking up, you know, being more vocal about it. I went through, you know, part of the reason I wrote my piece was I went through 3 decades of my life not talking about how much of an impact this had on my life and how many problems it created for me. And, you know, I had this sort of like radicalizing moment when I like hit a breaking point, like late last year. And I was like, I got to do something about this. And I started reading a little bit and it kind of radicalized me where it's like, you know, why have I spent so long shouldering all this bullshit on my own? And all these other people do too. And they just don't talk about it and they don't try and make things, you know, better for themselves. So I think if more families, you know, start speaking up, I'm not a huge believer in calling your congressmen and stuff like that, but there are millions of people around the country. You know, there's, you know, what is it, 11? I just saw this in the Washington Post. More than 1 in 10 children in the United States have been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. 1 in 10 children. How many families is that? You know, like, if half those people like got really pissed and started causing a stink, I think politicians would notice really quick.
Yeah. That statistic is both, you know, the reason people should kind of, you know, maybe campaign on this issue or do something of it, but it's also the problem too, isn't it? I mean, the sense that people see 1 in 10, they say, well, that's too much. They don't know this. They don't know if that's accurate. They say, well, that's the overdiagnosis right there. You know, so it's a kind of a two-way street in that way.
You know, it's the another thing that's happening is there some medical group is going to put out actual stricter or like definitive guidelines on adult ADHD. So hopefully that will help with the diagnosis part, because right now there's pretty loose standards. There's not really strict or like good guidance for professionals on diagnosing it. So that'll be coming down the pipe. So I think if we can get the overdiagnosis or frivolous diagnosis under control and get more people who have real problems to advocate for themselves, maybe we can make some progress.
Well, CJ, thank you for sharing that. Thank you for writing the story.
Yes. And, thank you, sir.
And we'll have you back on when I'm totally out. And I will ask you. And, you know, I have to say, I'm also not a fan of calling your congressman. But there is one thing that with, you know, drugs of this worked, and that was insulin. People did really kind of rise up on the prices of insulin and things like that. And, you know, Donald Trump took it up and, you know, every politician has taken this up. And there are far fewer type 1 diabetics, I think. But yeah, my insulin is now, I think, capped at $30 or $25 a month. So maybe it'll work.
Whatever, communist.
No comment. No comment.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's the best thing. I'm just saying that's what happened. I don't want anyone getting involved, but you know, I want them to get involved for the government not to get involved. I want the government to get involved to make the government become less involved, if that makes sense.
I hear you. I hear you.
All right,
CJ. Thank you very much, man. I really appreciate you writing this. You're doing the Lord's work. Keep fighting for us, the real victims in America.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, guys. Right. It was a pleasure.
We know of new methods of attack. Trojan horse.